Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to the November meeting of the Forest Practices Board. We have a new member who is joining us for the first time today, and I'd like to introduce to my right, Mark Calhoun from the Department of Commerce. Mark, would you just give us a few, perhaps, words of your background?
I'm with Commerce. I've been there since 1990. I manage our international trade program, which includes our network of foreign offices around the world. By way of background, I have a degree in forestry. Worked in the Forest Service for a couple of years. Then went overseas and worked on a fast-growing tropical softwood deforestation project. When I came back to the U.S. in the late 80s, I worked for Weyerhaeuser for a couple of years and then joined Commerce in 1990. So the last 4 or 5 years, I haven't been working very closely with forestry, more on the international front, but look forward to getting back into some forestry issues.
Terrific. Thank you. And then on my right, starting with board introductions, please.
Anna Jackson, Director's Designee from Fish and Wildlife.
Doug Stinson, General Public Member, Small Forest Landowner.
Dave Herrera, General Public Member.
Paula Sweeney, General Public Member.
And Peter Goldmark, Commissioner of Public Lands.
Morning, everyone. Tom Lorraine, Designee for Ecology.
Sherry Fox, representing the Independent Contract Logger.
Good morning. I'm Tom Davis, Designee from the Department of Agriculture.
Norm Schaaf, General Public Member.
Carolyn Dobbs, General Public Member.
Thank you. And I believe we have Dave Summers on the phone. Dave, are you there?
Yes, I am. Dave Summers, Washington County.
All right. Thank you. And we have one late arrival.
You're lucky I'm here at all.
Would you please introduce yourself?
Well, I know who I am. My name's Bill Little. I represent the Timber Products Unions.
All right, thank you, Bill. And just, you missed the one introduction. We have Mark Calhoun with us today. He's the member who's representing Commerce.
Okay.
So I believe we're all here, either here in Olympia or one remotely by phone. And I think at this point, we'll go on to our safety briefing, please.
Good morning. In the event of a fire, alarms will sound and flash. Please leave this room using the double doors in the front of the room. In the event of an earthquake, alarms may not sound and flash. Please drop to the floor and cover your head as best as you can, or go under a table. After the shaking has stopped, leave this room using the double doors. In the event of any evacuation of a building, staff will lead you out of the building using the double doors in front of the room, right here, and lead you away from the building towards the grassy area along Jefferson Street. DNR employees are trained and equipped to assist you in checking in and responding to emergencies. So at this time, please turn off your noise-making devices. Thank you.
All right, thank you for that. The next item on this morning's agenda is approval of the minutes from the August regular meeting. These minutes have been mailed to board members. What is your disposition on these minutes, please?
Move approval.
Second. A motion. Seconded by Doug. Was that a second from you?
No, I second the minutes.
Okay, so we have a motion properly supported. Any discussion on the motion? A call for a vote. All those in favor of approving the minutes, raise your hand, please. Dave Summers, how do you vote?
My hand's up.
All right, thank you. I couldn't quite see it. All right, so that's a unanimous approval of the minutes. Thank you for that, board. And the next item on this agenda this morning is a report from your chair. We've got quite a few things to mention, but I'd like to start off with the just an update to the board on the Taylor's Checker Spot Butterfly Management Plan has been developed and signed by DNR State Lands. And I believe WFW and Anna might have some comment about this, please.
I do. Thank you. Staff was encouraging me, and I wanted to take the opportunity to thank DNR for their collaborative participation in this, allowing us to influence it, and we think it's just it's a great example of of two state agencies working together for habitat management issues, and especially Olympic Region DNR staff. So just wanted to say thanks.
All right, you're welcome, and it's good to always good to partner with you folks. So I think in my report this morning for the board, I'd like to remind the board and obviously the audience as well that we have an upcoming session that will start in early January of 2011. We've got some major policy issues there, but of course the biggest lift is the state's budget. We know that the budget at this point is projected to be somewhere in the neighborhood of $4 billion to $4.5 billion. That's the deficit anticipated in the state's general fund. And although this is a long session, I think we can all anticipate a difficult time as we in state government both tighten our belt but still maintain our capacity to do the work that the public needs us to do and expects us to do even during these very difficult budgetary times. DNR has submitted its budget proposal to OFM for consideration in the governor's budget, and I want this board to understand that we have submitted a decision package which includes funding for the forest riparian easement program at the level of $10 million. We feel this is an important program that needs to be funded. And also for FFFP, another $10 million request for that, and $2 million for the riparian open space program to fund both backlog and anticipated applications during the upcoming biennium. These programs are very important to small forest landowners, and we know of that importance, and we want to do everything we can to make sure that that funding is there for those programs. I think this board is also aware through the rulemaking process that we're engaged in of the effort on the RMAP program. And the governor and myself have written a letter back east to our federal legislators, and we will be working with them to hopefully get some assistance from the federal budget on funding for FFFP and other needs around the RMAP program. So this has been a very collaborative effort that has resulted in two things. One is the rulemaking that we're engaged here that we will touch on briefly today, but also in the ongoing effort to seek additional funding to make sure that we can protect the resource as best as possible. So that completes my report to the board. Are there any questions on the issues that I brought up in my report?
Yes. One question on the funding for your budget requests. Are those, just for my own edification, are those all capital dollars?
Those are all capital requests. DNR has made no requests above our current authority for operating dollars. That's been an important policy because we know of the very difficult situation the state's been in. Other questions? All right, moving on then in this morning's agenda, we have an opportunity for public comment on general board topics. Staff, has there been anybody signed up to comment on particular topics? We have five members of the public who've signed up to make comment this morning. First is Ken Miller, please. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning. Commissioner Goldmark and members of the board, I want to reaffirm my written testimony that I sent out earlier, which I think is in your packets. that complements the department for the forest repair and easements program hearing process. There are clearly some improvements in the recommendations. There are still some serious problems in the recommendations that Mary will present later, but it's very clear that the department heard the landowner complaints in those recommendations. I also want to, are also attached to my written testimony, are several RCW and WAC excerpts that were intended to help your understanding of the increasing level of discouragement and impatience on the part of small forest landowners. So just in kind of hitting on a couple of them that were in the attachment, the third bullet down is RCW 76.13.100, and it states in part that the legislature further finds that small forest landowners should have alternate harvest restrictions on smaller harvest units that may have relatively low impact on aquatic resources. I think that's a promise that is at least a partial basis for Rick and Steve's presentation, which will follow this morning. Kind of the best one that summarizes, I think, all the RCWs and WACs is the middle one in the page, which is RCW 7609.368 in its intent language. And it says in part, the legislature intends that the small forest landowners have access to alternate land processes or alternate harvest restrictions, or both, if necessary, that meet the public resource protection standards, but which also lowers the overall cost of regulation to small forest landowners, including, but not limited to, their timber value foregone, their layout costs, and their operating costs. Excuse me. It also goes on to say the Forest Practice Board shall consult with the Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee in developing these alternate approaches. Perhaps some of the past problems or lost opportunities could have been avoided if we had worked more directly with the board. And particularly for the newer members, I've also brought copies that will be passed out here of a more extensive white paper that better demonstrates the numerous failures of Forest and Fish to deliver on the promises to the small forest landowners. These failures help explain the need for a legislative solution. Thank you for your consideration. I'd be delighted to take any questions.
Thank you very much, Ken. I appreciate your comments. Chris Mendoza. Good morning, Chris.
Good morning.
Dave, are you hearing these? This audio okay?
Yes, everything's just fine. Thank you.
Okay. Proceed.
Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning, board members, particularly new board members. My name is Chris Mendoza, and this morning I'm providing comments as a member of the public, not affiliated with any stakeholder groups behind me. I want to provide comments in support of the alternate plan process that that Ken spoke to before me for small forest landowners, and to add to the all the understanding that the small forest landowners have a unique burden, if you will, that are not faced by large landowners. I think that people tend to forget that small forest landowners are essentially asked to provide protections and ecosystem services and other things to an urban society that has elected to forgo those same protections and services. And in doing so, faces a steeper hill to climb because they suffer from an economy of scale issue that I think everyone understands. You have 100 acres and suddenly 50 of it's eaten up by protections, then it doesn't leave you much to work with. So having worked with the alternate plan process, I think there is potential there that has yet to be tapped into that may assist small forest landowners with some of the things that Ken mentioned about flexibility in the rules, so long as they meet the overall effectiveness of standard rules, which I think everyone's familiar with, and may be potentially defined as low impact. I think there's also room where the rules that we have today, I think mostly they were around, that negotiated them, understand they were sort of a broad brush. They were negotiated with the understanding that they would cover a large area of land with a highly variable landforms. In other words, there are unique landforms within those ownerships that may or may not require the same prescriptions there in rules. So I think there's a lot of room there to work with through an alternate plan process with the state and with others that would allow for achievement of those or overall effectiveness of protections and rules while giving small force landowners the flexibility they require. Thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Chris, I know you've been very actively involved in the adaptive management program and the forest and fish policy, so that's one of your other hats that you wear. And given the testimony you've just given, is that forum an opportunity where some of these things can and should be addressed, even though I know that that plate is pretty darn full, and it may be some at times a slow and cumbersome process, but still, from your perspective, sitting in that chair, and with the thoughts that you've just brought to us, is that a place where we should be working to try to achieve some of those common goals?
I'd say yes and no. I think that there's, right now, with the current budget where it is, as the commissioner pointed out, and if you're talking specifically about the science committee, that would be CMER, they've got a pretty big list already to prioritize, and most of the things on that list are directed at some of the projects that are linked with descriptions and the rule package that have the highest potential for risk of public resources. And that doesn't always necessarily match up with concerns of the small forest landowners and the alternate plan process. We just don't have the resources to do that, quite frankly, and sometimes we don't have the tools. We know a lot about large industrial landowners, but they have the resources to create GIS systems and other things, small. Policy, I think, is a different case where, I think as many of you know, policy can often get things done with the direction of the board and the commissioner outside of that box. So I think it may be more potential there.
And that was maybe more specific rather than the science question, which I know needs to be done through the CMER process. Most effectively, at least, but policy does have some opportunity to direct things.
Well, yeah, as examples, we have the 20 trees per acre under DFC was worked through policy and board. The fixed width buffer proposal. So there are other things that can be accomplished outside of that.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Chris.
You're welcome.
Sean Cantrell. Morning, Sean.
Good morning. Thank you, Commissioner. Thank you, board members. My name is Sean Cantrell. I'm the Executive Director of Seattle Audubon Society. I was a member of the Forest Practice Board's 2009 Northern Spotted Owl Policy Working Group, and I'm a current member of the Forest Practice Board's Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team. When our working group finalized a set of recommendations that was presented to this board almost a year ago, we saw them as a way to move past the contentious fights that have dominated much of the discussion around forest practices while making strategic contributions to the conservation of a viable population of the northern spotted owl. They are supposed to be part of a new paradigm among the stakeholders. I'm here today for Seattle Audubon because we're deeply concerned that with the minimal progress to date moving these recommendations into reality. We want this incentives approach to work, but there's been little meaningful progress made on the ground in actually implementing these so far. I recognize the limited resources that state agencies are grappling with, as well as the desire to not duplicate the modeling and analysis that's being done by the federal agencies that are revising the Northern Spotted Owl Recovery Plan. But there's a responsibility for the state to act. And unfortunately, in our opinion, much of the promise of the recommendations seems to have stalled the victim of what I call benign neglect. Unless we collectively find a way to jumpstart real on-the-ground actions implementing this incentives package, I fear that the venue for addressing the pressing challenges facing both the owl and landowners will move from the collaborative forums back into an administrative or even judicial battles. At the recent Northwest Environmental Forum, there was talk about transformative change, what it's going to take to get landowners to be able to have the incentives to stay working the land and protect endangered species and other natural resources. And there's a lot of really wonderful talk and suggestions and, you know, desire to do things. But our opinion is that there hasn't been a whole lot of action on this regard. And the Spotted Owl Working Group recommendations is a good example of how there have been great recommendations to move towards this incentives approach, the voluntary actions, but there's been darn little action on the ground that's really making it a reality. And again, I realize there's resources are strapped and that is a huge part of the challenge, but there's also just the fact that I think we haven't focused on it as a community, whether that be the Forest Practice Board, whether that be the stakeholder groups such as mine and industry agencies and others. There's a need to jumpstart this process now. At the forum, I said, I don't know where I'm going to get it, but I'll commit $25,000 on behalf of the conservation community to fund a person, an instigator, I'd call him, somebody with a sharp stick to poke us all and keep us moving forward. Unfortunately, nobody else has stepped up and said they'll find 5 cents, let alone $5,000 or $50,000 or whatever it would take. Again, this one person's not going to solve the problem, but what seems to me, in my opinion anyway, to be the biggest challenge is that it's nobody's responsibility to make these a reality. We've all got full-time jobs, we've all got too many things on our plate, not enough resources, and so if we could find one person who could help facilitate and move this process along, it would go a long way towards keeping us on a collaborative approach as opposed to falling back into lots of bickering, lots of people coming before you saying, we need this rule changed, we need this strengthened, we need this removed, whatever it might be. So I urge you guys to use your Bowie pulpit to say, folks, get together, find some money, hire somebody to go out there. We'll house them. If you don't trust Audubon to be the house for it, we'll find another place to house this person. But we need to have somebody step forward and help fund this effort to make real on-the-ground changes. So with that, I'm happy to answer questions or get off my soapbox.
Carolyn?
So how long would you think that this poker would need to be employed?
I suggest that we need at least 2 years. And at the forum, there were some folks, Mark Domit suggested that I think appropriately that we could try to ask the legislature for some money. But if we got some money from the legislature, which is by no means a certain thing in this climate, that money won't show up until at least July or August. And then you hire a person, or, you know, it's going to take even longer. We need somebody to be doing this now. So that's why I'm asking, you know, nonprofit groups, industry groups, whoever it is, find some money now. It's not going to take a huge amount of money. For $100,000, I think, a year, we could have a robust one-person shop making some real actions moving this along. Again, I don't know where I'm going to find $25,000, but if other people step up, I'll make sure I do. All right.
I was just going to say, it would be a shame to lose all the progress that we've made and have to basically go back to square zero. I think to see that happens.
Yes, Paul.
I just would like to offer the model. I've been a part of a couple work groups that have been sponsored jointly or run jointly by Department of Natural Resources and Department of Ecology, and the two chairs, Stephen Bernath and Craig Partridge, with some help of a facilitator, have been able to, you know, get a group of stakeholders to do a lot of work, and so they've acted very effectively as a prod carbon issues and some other issues as well. And so that kind of model where it's not very expensive, and so the kind of person that Sean is talking about that could be assigned to do this in conjunction with some part-time help from agency staff, I think could get a lot of work done. So, I would just encourage us all to listen to Sean's recommendation and say that I think that there's other models in which a group of determined people can get a whole lot of work done without a tremendous amount of money. And I think that this topic calls for that.
So thank you for your generous offer, Sean.
Thanks.
Okay. Carol Whitaker. Good morning, Carol.
Good morning, Commissioner and board members. I'm Carol Whitaker. I'm the staff scientist and policy analyst at Washington Forest Law Center. And as Sean stated, it's been about 9 months since you were presented with the 7 consensus recommendations of the Northern Spotted Owl Policy Working Group. And these recommendations are based primarily on voluntary incentives. They're expected to result in the strategic contribution of non-federal lands towards conservation of a viable population of the spotted owl in Washington. I listed the recommendations here for you to read just as a refresher. Earlier this year, you accepted these recommendations and then asked DNR to create the implementation team. And they were intended to create a work plan and for implementing the recommendations, among other tasks. This team was expected to complete its work by the end of this year, but to my knowledge, no work plan yet exists, and none of these recommendations have been fully implemented thus far. In the meantime, spotted owl habitat continues to be harvested, and our owl population continues to decline with no end in sight. These circumstances call for the protection of every known owl, unless and until it can be scientifically shown that such protection is unnecessary for the recovery of the population. The Spotted Owl Technical Science Team, which is yet to be convened, ought to help answer this important question. Until the Technical Science Team completes its assignment and the consensus recommendations are implemented and demonstrably working, I urge you to please enact interim protections for spotted owls. The state's existing rules for owl circles inside of SOCES must be extended to all circles outside of SOCES that are likely to be occupied, as well as to any site centers established as a result of new owl detections. Thank you.
Thank you. Peter Goldman. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning, Commissioner.
Good morning, Board.
I'm Peter Goldman, Director of the Washington Forest Law Center. As the Commissioner said, this is a time of tremendous upheaval and fiscal challenges for the state government. And I want to just take this moment to ask this board to ask itself to how it can best efficiently and economically serve the people in this very difficult capacity that we're situation we're in. There's more on the horizon that's been mentioned. There's potential consolidation of the natural resource agencies, major budget reductions, less money for enforcement of the rules themselves. There was no mention of the consistency of funding to the Forest and Fish Adaptive Management Program. We know that we're funded through 2011. We don't know what happens after that. And there's also consideration by the governor eliminating all boards or making them advisory and vesting rulemaking authority in individuals or some sort. Everything's on the table. And concurrently with those changes, we have tremendous challenges to where we are now. The small forest landowners are seeking to carve out all 20-acre FPAs owned by small forest landowners from the protections of the 9.5 million acre HCP. And there's been discussion, I don't know where it is, but some folks are asking the legislature to eliminate the permit system, so there would just be advisory system, a notice system, and we'll just assume that the rules will be complied with. So there's some challenges there. So given this landscape, is this board ever, is it going to be the constant pattern, well, in a perfect world, if we had money to do this, we would do it? Is that where we're going to end up on all of these processes? As everyone knows, this is a tremendously complex process. I think there are two recommendations that I can make that would help this board do its work in this difficult environment. And one is that board members should proactively set targets and deadlines. The best two examples are some of the languishing projects in forest and fish adaptive management. Hasn't even, after 2 years post-mortem, still hasn't even gotten to the University of Washington Science Review. It's still hung up. Spotted owls, as we know, a lot of promises. This is just the incentives side, hasn't even gotten anywhere. This board needs to proactively sort of get out of this staff show and tell where and stakeholders do all the work and come and report to you folks. And I think that those who want to see things move forward need to proactively set deadlines, announce goals, and let's move efficiently for the people. We have 13 people here. We cannot, the state will not tolerate a situation where we just have a big black hole where nothing happens. I think this board is going to put itself out of business, and I don't think that's necessarily a good thing. The second thing is that I think that this board needs to use its bully pulpit more effectively in the budget process and with the DNR. The rules can only accomplish so much in preserving working forestry. We all want working forestry. With all due respect, I don't think rollbacks are viable or foreseeable for any of the species. I think the true gains of protecting working landscapes are going to be made in fora that are not in this boardroom. Ecosystem services markets, all the sort of panoply of different things that are out there, smart tax policies, certification, marketing, those are where the gains are going to be made. They're not going to be made here. This board needs to think of that, it needs to understand its limitations and work outside the structure of the board to try to implement these things at the legislature and not simply just get into this, we're just regulators. Ask the board, everybody on this board has in a potentially important position to advance those issues. The funding, the user pay system is inevitable. We cannot tolerate a situation where we're paying $50 forest practice permits that is funding a program that is, it's only funding 1% of the forest practices program. And conversely, we can't, we just cannot rely on the state budget to provide those essential services anymore. We need to shift into a user pay mode. So anyway, with that said, I'll be back to you on some of the other items, but it's really important that this board look at what it's doing and not just work on what comes to it, but be more proactive in setting deadlines.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Miguel?
Good morning, Commissioner, and good morning to the board. Good to see everyone. I just want to make a couple brief comments on the small forest landowner issue and one comment on the owl issue. We already heard most of this already today, but I just want to get a little different perspective. You know, I think on the PREP funding, part of our problem are the legislature, particularly working with the committee chairs, not really understanding how that program was funded and why it was set up. I think we still have some education to do there. And the whole issue around prioritization, I think, is still something that they don't quite understand. That in fact, you know, these lands were prioritized for conservation as a result of the conservation strategy that went into the ACP. So that piece of it was already addressed. I just wanted to add, I know that the $10 million backlog that your staff has identified, it's a lot of money in this current budget situation. But I think, again, we'll need to educate the legislature that $10 million, yes, is a lot, but this is Washington State's timber industry is based on this, currently based on this permit, and it's a multi-billion dollar industry. Not to mention all the conservation strategies that have been put in place that we're trying to see are going to be effective. There's a lot of time and money been placed into that. And also all the amount of the $192 million that the timber industry itself has put into road improvements based on this permit. So there's a lot at stake here. And I think whether or not the legislation proposed by the small forest landowners does get signed by the governor or not is really not the issue. The issue is how we can keep this program viable. Regarding the owls, I'd just like to remind the board that I worked on that committee, and there was a consensus recommendation made, but there were also some non-consensus recommendations that were part of the report. And I think in the conservation caucus strategy, our concern always was how quickly and how effectively the voluntary incentives would be implemented. And as you heard earlier, they're not moving along as quickly as we thought and as we were afraid might happen. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Kevin Gabu. Morning, Kevin.
Good morning. Good morning, members of the board and commissioner. My name is Kevin Gabu, and I represent the Weyerhaeuser Company. I didn't get a chance to talk to Sean before the meeting, so I don't want to kick his legs out underneath him, but I will say that during the recent Northwest Forest Forum, we did make an announcement, and it was expressed by several folks there about the need for money. And the comment that I'd like to make today is that the Weyerhaeuser Company Foundation will be providing a $20,000 grant to the Northwest Forest Forum specifically to facilitate this move towards on incentives. And given that my company paid another $5,000 for the last forum, I think that's the $25 that Sean's looking for. So if he wants to write his check today, then we can call it good. But all aside, I do think it's important and a commitment from not only the company and the foundation, but for the industry and others that going forward, we do need to use forums like the University of Washington Forest Forum and try to explore and see if this third track is possible to generate some outside revenue and solve some of these problems in a non-traditional way. Because trying to solve issues like saving the spotted owl is not going to be easy, and it may not be even possible. I mean, we have millions and millions of acres of high-quality habitat dedicated to the conservation of the northern spotted owl, yet the population continues to decline. And if the board or others think that a few thousand or 100,000 acres of private forest lands in the state of Washington is going to turn the corner, I don't think that's going to work out. So we need to see what the modeling and the technical work does. But let's not kid ourselves. We have a competitor problem. It's called the barred owl. We have a rapid decline of the species. And from the perspective of the Weyerhaeuser Company, I don't think more habitat is going to solve the problem. It's a very tough problem. And to think that either regulatory or other actions will solve it may be a bit naive. So we have to do our best, but any expectation that a simple solution is available needs to be dismissed, and we need to work together to see what type of approaches we can pull together to maybe change the time there. Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin. Carolyn has a question for you, Kevin. Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah. So at the recent forum, were there some particular suggestions or concrete ideas that sounded good from your perspective, or things that you think are particularly worth pursuing?
There is a lot of work in terms of how to, if you will, there's still, I agree with a lot of the other comments that, you know, there's a lot of theory out there, but bringing the economics to bear is the tough part. And so I think the best part about the forum and the people that are there is the commitment to try to, you know, push through it. So obviously we need, you know, a permanent dedicated funding source. How do we do that? We don't quite know yet, but I think, you know, there's a commitment to try and explore it. And, you know, I think one of the areas that we talked a lot about actually was the transfer of development rights, and that there appears to be some momentum in the conservation community and folks that have traditionally opposed those to support legislation this year. And so if we can figure out ways to do that, that can provide a funding mechanism where we can get dollars coming from urban areas to rural areas. I think those are the type of things we need to work on.
Thank you.
Actually, I have a quick question for Kevin. So the $20,000 from the Weyerhaeuser Foundation,
Correct. So that
went to the forum itself, but not necessarily to this position that Sean was talking about?
Right.
So I've got to deliver a check next week, and Brian's going to give me a beer at that point for delivering the check to him. But I think, you know, from our perspective, the forum has been a good place where we've been able to bring people together in kind of the non-regulatory, non-litigation, and you know, start the dialogue. And so from our perspective, it's pretty much the only game in town right now that's kind of serving as that collaborative facility. And so we can talk to Brian about how to utilize that dollars and maybe get some more matches, and that may be the place to start, and we'll see how it goes. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So that completes the opportunity for public comment, right on time. I've made a slight adjustment to the agenda for today. I hope the board is comfortable with that. Because of a scheduling conflict for a staff member, I've moved an afternoon item up to the bottom of the staff reports. So this is to accommodate conflict in scheduling. That'll be the report on the Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team update. That'll fall right at the end of staff reports. So moving into those reports, please. Adaptive management, Jim. Good morning, Jim.
Good morning. Good morning, members of the board. My name is Jim Hotbed. I'm your Adaptive Management Program Administrator. And for my staff report, I'm bringing good news. If you recall, last March, CMER submitted three applications to EPA for grant proposals. Ecology submitted one on behalf of CMER, and the DNR submitted two on behalf of CMER. In August, after the last board meeting, Ecology received notice that they were in line for one of those grants, and in fact did get it. So Ecology got a grant of $694,000, and what that'll do is take care of the first 4 years of the Type N experimental buffer in soft rock lithologies project. So they'll be contributing $694,000. Ecology itself will be contributing another $1.1 million, and then CMER is going to have to come to policy in the board approximately 4 years from now for another $820,000, since this is an 8-year project.
So, excuse me, Jim, sure. But I see Ecology's representative.
Not no, I'm doing the numbers.
$100,000 this year, $150,000 each year thereafter.
Okay.
Until the project is completed. So it's not this year.
Oh, my wallet burning.
All right, so that's the good news on adaptive management funding.
That's the good news.
All right, thank you. Next one is board manual update. Vanelle, good morning.
Good morning, Commissioner. Good morning, fellow board members. My name is Donnell Mahan. I work in the policy and services section, and I am replacing Mark Engel's old position. The DNR is going to convene a stakeholder group for the guidelines for forest roads. We will develop guidance recommendations from the Forest and Fish Policy Committee regarding extensions and procedures. We'll begin this in November. We convened a stakeholder group for the Riparian Open Space Program. We are currently in the process of writing that board manual, and the last one is the watershed analysis of board manual section 11, and we're in the process of gathering that stakeholder group together and beginning the prioritization and reanalysis processes. All of these board manuals will be presented to you for approval at the May 2011 meeting. Are there any questions?
Yes, Nora?
She tried to get out.
Yeah, just try it. thank you for the report, and I appreciate the intended completion date, because I think that is consistent with our rulemaking activities, and it allows the rulemaking and the manuals to be considered concurrently, which should make for a much better process. ultimately. Question about the guidelines for forest roads. And could you tell me a little more about the intent of that and how that complements or contrasts with our maps and the BMPs and so on that are all contained in rule already?
Mark's going to go into further discussion on that later on the RMAP portion to give you a better of all the components that are going into that. We won't be opening up the typical BMPs. What we're going to be looking at is trying to go towards explaining the 8 components that are currently required for the RMAP plan. Kind of getting down into the weeds on that, but looking at how to be consistent across the state and moving towards that. Of course, we have the 3, the fish barriers, the things that are expected, and explaining those details better in the board manual. Again, try not to make the board manual rule, but giving clear criteria so that everyone can be as consistent as possible across the state is the intent. How we move towards that, we'll get there at that first and second meeting. Does that answer you?
That helps, thank you.
Mark's definitely going to elaborate further, and that will help clarify it.
Thank you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Compliance monitoring, Walt. Morning, Walt.
Good morning, Commissioner and board members. I want to give you a status update on compliance monitoring program and where we are so far. So the 2010 field work is nearly complete. We got 99% of the sample applications done for the year. Got one more to do tomorrow, and we'll be done for all the field work this year. For the remainder of the year, we're going to be working on the selection and of the 2011 sample and assignments and actually the data entry of 2010. We want to restructure some of the data features so that we have some easier reporting. The field review is in progress for the haul route sampling that we want to engage next year. We got some more work to do on the mechanics to make sure that it comes out and fits easily into the system. I was prepared today to present the summary of the 2008-2009 results, but a decision was made to postpone that presentation until actually after the report is published. That's probably a good idea. It gives you a chance to review the report completely and come back to me with some harder questions and you'd be able to come to me today with. So we had some unanticipated revisions to display some of these aggregations differently, and so that caused a little bit of delay, which we hadn't anticipated. We expect the stakeholders to begin reviewing it in the next 2 weeks, with publication expected in January. Clean water assurances. The dispute resolution milestone has been completed and was recently accepted. For riparian noncompliance, those results are being included in the result in the compliance monitoring report for the 2008-2009 set. I still have work to do to address the riparian noncompliance that occurred in the previous biennium. The stakeholders meeting, stakeholders met on October 25th. They previewed the presentation I was going to give, and we'll have another meeting on December 13th. So that's the current status of compliance monitoring. Any questions?
All right. Thank you, Walt. Rulemaking activity, Mark.
Morning, Mark. Good morning, Commissioner, members of the board. I'm Mark Dingle. I'm the Policy and Services Assistant for the Forest Practice Division. The staff report for rulemaking, 4 of the rulemakings listed in this report will be addressed today. They're part of today's agenda. 2, the Riparian Open Space Program has already gone through 30-day review. We're looking at the February meeting to bring that package to the board to initiate rulemaking. And the notice to forest practices to affected Indian tribes We're still working on draft language, and right now our target is to bring that to the board also at the February meeting. Are there any questions?
All right. Thank you, Mark. Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee and Small Forest Landowner Office. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Commissioner and members of the board. I'm Mary McDonald, and I'm with the Small Forest Landowner Office, and I'm the office manager. I'm going to just run down a couple of the things that is in the memoranda. The Small Forest Landowner Advisory Committee met on October 5th, and they continue to focus on each of the caucus's perspectives regarding alternate management plans and alternate harvest prescriptions regarding low-impact harvests. I'm going to also talk a little later, probably in about a half hour, regarding the forest riparian easement question program. So I'll just skip to the next one. The forest stewardship program, we're currently getting ready to work with Washington State University to reintroduce something called the Forest Stewardship Notes. So we're working in collaboration with those on a newsletter. We're pretty excited about that. The Family Forest Fish Passage Program, we recently completed 28 barriers for this construction season, and we have also submitted several grants that we're anxiously awaiting to hear whether we acquire them. A long-term application program, or the long-term forest practice application, the numbers are right there, but just as a quick overview, there was an increase of 3 since July. So we could do better, I think, as far as having more small landowners apply for that program. The riparian open space, we recently had a riparian open space technical committee meet and review 8 applications. 11 were submitted and 8 were determined to be eligible. And that committee consisted of ecology, a WDFW, Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, and the Office of Recreation and Conservation, and a specialist regarding channel migration zones, and ranked those applications and were proceeding with the acquisition of those. I'm open for any questions.
Just a good question. Good to hear the stewardship notes are coming back, Mary. That's great. How did you get the funding?
WSU.
Okay. So grant.
It's with a grant from WSU, and they are the ones that are providing the funding. We're going to implement them by putting them into our existing newsletter.
So will Gibbs be doing the writing of the notes, or?
The notes are going to be written mostly by WSU, and then David Bergville, okay, our outreach specialist, will be assisting with that.
Great.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks.
Northern Spotted Owl Implementation Team Update. Chuck?
Morning, Chuck.
Good morning. So, Commissioner, thank you for accommodating my conflict this afternoon, although all the comments made about our group, in retrospect, maybe I wouldn't have done that, just left. But in your packet, you do have an update, and most of the update material is on the top of the second page of that. The first page is mainly just background of who the group is and what we've done today. The frustration that you heard this morning that Sean and others expressed, that's not new. Sean certainly has talked with me about that today. He's talked with David and with Department of Fish and Wildlife, since we're the two state representatives on that group. I think that frustration is one that we all share. And it seems as if in every one of the conversations that we're having on this issue of incentives, ecosystem services, marketplace, we would all have to admit we're doing a lot more talking about it than we are in actually getting anything on the ground. I can't disagree with that at all. If you remember, one of the first tasks our implementation team was asked to do, one of the very first discussions that we came back and had with you, was whether the group felt it needed facilitation or not. And we came back and said no. And what we looked at in our group was whether we were of enough like mind that we needed facilitation to get us through conflict. And I think rightly we told you, no, we think the five of us can work together to move this forward. Again, in retrospect, we probably should have taken a harder look at exactly what all of us have the capability to do right now and whether that could have been assisted by facilitation. So I think what you're hearing from Sean, from Kevin, and I don't think any of us would disagree, that dedicated resource to this would certainly be helpful. But I don't see the ability for us, meaning DNR, and I think WDFW shares this, I don't think we have the ability to provide that kind of dedicated resource right now. That's one of the frustrations. What we have been doing, it basically falls within three areas. There were three of the team members who did participate in the Northwest Environmental Forum discussions that you heard mentioned. Sean was there, Kevin Godbu was there, I was there. Although David was not able to make it, WDFW was represented, Anna was able to attend. So we did spend a couple of days in October participating in that discussion. The other thing that we have been doing in about the last 6 weeks has been looking at the first draft of the revised federal recovery plan that was put out in early September. It was a 60-day comment period. That comment period is due to end on Monday the 15th, but I've been told by Ken Berg of the Fish and Wildlife Service that there will be a public announcement this week that that's going to be extended for 30 days. So that should take the comment period from 15 November up to roughly mid-December. I haven't seen that announcement yet, but I've been told it will be out this week. The last thing that we've been doing, pending sort of movement on the recovery plan, and again, the reason we're looking to the recovery plan is because of the modeling efforts that are being conducted there. One of the changes in this draft revision is there is a recognition of an increased importance of non-federal lands. And again, that's given the continued and rapid decline of the owl. That's a change to the recovery plan in the past. And there's modeling being done by the federal services to try to determine what kind of aggregation of federal and potentially non-federal areas, which ones might have the most positive impacts to the owl. That modeling is not included in the draft revision that's out at this point, although the services have told me they do expect at least enough of that modeling to be included in their final, which was originally due out in December. I think that's now slipped to January, for our technical team to go ahead and use what's available at that time to look at what may be a significant contribution that we could look at from the non-federal lands in Washington. So that's why we're waiting rather than having to try to do our own modeling, which again, we have no resources to do, or to try to utilize what they're already doing. And again, that should be available in January. We expect to convene that technical team as quickly as we can after that, hopefully late January or early February, to get them started looking at that. Be glad to answer any questions.
Carol, this first.
What about looking at some foundation sources for money there, you know, in terms of maybe getting a fellow to come and work with you? I would think that an application that, you know, showed the history of collaboration and the diversity of involvement would provide a pretty strong case for a policy fellow that provide some of the facilitation role, but also the type of gathering stuff, helping you move and so forth.
That might be a possibility. It's certainly not something we've looked at to this point. Is that something you would have additional information about if I give you a call? All right. I'll do
that. Talk to you at the break.
One other thing I would mention, in the update here, I mentioned a list of reading materials about the issue of marketplace options. Board Member Dobbs has asked that I provide that, so I'll get that out to all of the board members in case you're interested in taking a look at any of the materials we're looking at.
Norm?
Thank you.
Chuck, you'd mentioned the modeling work that is being done relative to non-federal lands, and just for my own clarification, does that non-federal then include the Washington State Department of Natural Resources lands that are covered by your own agency's HCP?
There are a variety of different scenarios that are being modeled. There had also been an offer made by the Fish and Wildlife Service that if our implementation team has something specific that it wants, that we want them to look at. For example, do we want them to model the current SOCES as a part of whatever strategy they end up recommending, they would be willing to do that. So at this point, I believe all of the lands are being included, regardless of the ownership. And once the potential importance of them is determined, then they will look at whether those lands may already be protected by some type of HCP or other agreement that's already in place. But the first step is to try to determine which of the lands are important to the owl.
Okay, so it's a biological and habitat driven process first, and then more of the political or ownership.
That's my understanding, yes.
Okay, thank you for that. I appreciate that clarification. More of a broad question. You started out by saying that at least some of the folks that are tasked with in this implementation committee simply don't have the time and the resources to get the work done in the time frames that had been anticipated. Does that mean that the group needs to change some members? I mean, there was a board appointment of that group, and if
I'm
they
certain.
Can't do it, do we need to look at that in a different way?
I'm certainly not going to speak for any other member of the implementation team. They will have to tell you themselves about their abilities to carry forward with it. For all five of us, though, this isn't the only job that we've got that we're trying to do. And I think that's not just the two state members on the team, that's the non-government entities as well. And that every step of the process takes a little longer than we would like, and normally a little longer than we plan. And I'm not sure that having different membership would resolve that.
Paula?
So, Chuck, you had said that the Fish and Wildlife Service anticipates having those modeling results out pertaining to non-federal lands in January sometime?
Some of them, and that's one of the kind of sticking points right now is exactly what will be included in January and what will then be done over the coming year or so after that final is out. The discussion that I've had with them, and this was with Ken, who is familiar with the plan of what will be in the final, he believes that it will have a level of modeling in it that will allow our technical team to take the next step forward. But certainly that will not be the end of their modeling at that time.
So I have a question maybe to pose to you, Commissioner, maybe to the rest of the board. If the first set of modeling result comes out and they have anything pertinent to say about non-federal lands, might it be appropriate to have someone from Fish and Wildlife Service come brief us at the February board meeting? And, you know, I understand that you've set up this technical team and they'll do a set of digestion, but just to keep us apprised and to be able to keep attention on the topic, because we've heard from stakeholders that it's sort of necessary to keep moving forward, it seems to me like it might be very helpful for us to understand the kinds of questions they're asking, the approach that they're using, what they've found to date, how that pertains to the specific recommendations in the draft recovery plan that were actually pointed at us very specifically. So that's a question.
But I'm wondering, Chuck, are they at a draft yet on this revision, or are they still in progress?
They're at a draft now. If they follow through with the timeline that they have right now, by your February meeting, that should be out of its draft form and in its final form. They had originally hoped to do that by the end of this calendar year, I think they're now recognizing that's probably going to slide into early January, but they still expect that timeline to be followed.
So I think what we could commit to is some dialogue with them and see if they're comfortable doing that. If in that time horizon they've reached a point where they're ready to do that. Okay?
I'd be glad to do that with Ken.
Any other questions? All right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chuck. So the next item on this morning's agenda is a proposed small forest landowner legislation. Thank you. Rick, welcome. I believe Steve's also here. Yeah. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning, Forest Practice Board members and Mr. Chair, and welcome, Mark. We'd like to acknowledge the new seat there. For the record, my name is Rick Dunning. I am together here with Steve Stinson, and we're speaking for the Washington Farm Forestry Association on behalf of our board and membership. And we truly are thankful for this opportunity to explain our association's legislative solution to the maintaining a full forest and fish HCP. We recognize your busy schedule. So, not knowing how many of you were able to watch the TVW video of this presentation that we were able to give back in July to the House Natural Resource Committee, we'll be presenting a little of it over again. So, Steve, you want to go ahead and start us through that?
Thank you for that introduction, and good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the board. I've been spending quite a bit of time walking and working in the forest, and would note that today is a great day to have a meeting.
Okay.
Yes.
There we go. So to start at the beginning, who are Washington State small forest landowners? We've got a WAC and an RCW that defines small forest landowners as those that harvest less than 2 million board feet on an annual basis. In western Washington, that's about 40 acres of 50-year-old Douglas fir. That number will get larger on the east side. This is what we call our million-dollar map. When we negotiated forest and fish, we had no idea how many small forest landowners there were, much less where they were on the landscape. The Washington Farm Forestry Association, in conjunction with the Family Forest Foundation, successfully advocated for about $1 million of federal funding to put this map together. It's housed at the University of Washington, and it's available for use. The dark green are the 215,000 small forest landowners we have in this state. The lighter green is the rest of the 25 million acres of timberland that we have. And it's pretty hard to pick out, but we've also tried to identify the 1,150 members of the Washington Farm Forestry Association, the 1,300 DNR Forest Stewardship Plans, and the 740 landowners that are members of the American Tree Farm System. I would encourage you to take a look at this data set and see if it can be used to inform the policy decisions this board makes.
Is that available on the web?
Yes, it is. All that information is at ruraltech.org, the Rural Technology Initiative, and I could be happy to provide that information. The Small Forest Landowner Office also uses and utilizes that information. Mary McDonald should be able to provide some additional references to that. So when we break things out a little bit further, we've got small forest landowners at about 50% of the private forest land. That makes us the largest ownership class by acreage. And from our perspective, it appears that we are being regulated under an industrial model. We use the data set to survey small forest landowners, try and figure out what it's going to take to keep them on the landscape. This survey was stratified by high, low, and high, medium, and low risk of conversion, which is another study available for your use. And we got a pretty decent response rate. I'm just going to go through this quickly. These findings are presented in a, what we call a Likert scale, one being of very low significance, five being of high significance. When landowners were asked what regulatory takings represent in terms of the challenges to maintaining their forest landscape, that was a high response. We asked landowners what percentage of the forest land investment they'd be willing to donate to society. Pretty significant numbers say none. When we asked them where regulatory complexity ranked, We have pretty significant response, about 60% in the 4 and 5 categories, listing that as a significant challenge to maintaining their forest land ownerships. Regulatory uncertainty falls in the same category. We've had 17 changes to the forest practices rule since its inception in 1973. I tried to grow my timber on an 80-year harvest rotation. When the rules change that rapidly, it's very difficult to plan.
So just a little more background to explain why we're here. Back in 99, when forest and fish rules were being worked on, the small forest landowner needs were not taken into account, and actually a recess was called in legislation to address our needs. And many of us specifically remember that time period, and our leadership at that time, including Sherry Fox, who worked so hard on this process, our past executive director, Nels Hansen, and others, were able to put together some simple but very important ideas that were to be met to bring us to the table. And we did accept that as a membership and agreed to come to the table based on those additional things, and therefore forced the fish passed. So those legislative commitments made in that agreement have not been maintained for small forest landowners. And we're seeking your support for our 2011 legislative proposal that will get us back on track. I also want to, and I shouldn't have to remind you, my friend Peter reminds you that often that, you know, you guys are charged with establishing rules to protect the state's natural resources while maintaining a viable timber industry, and we are part of that. And I just want to quickly mention a letter back in 2001 sent out by then-Commissioner Doug Sutherland after the Forest Practice Board adopted the permanent rules implementing forest and fish. And it was a very short letter on state seal, so we thought it was pretty important and kept it around. But I just, one of the small paragraphs on that short letter said, as part of Washington's forest and fish agreement, Washington becomes the first state in the nation to compensate small forest landowners for leaving timber along fish-bearing streams. Participating landowners are eligible to receive at least half of the commercial value of trees they leave standing to protect water quality and fish habitat. This was a pretty monumental deal and a pretty monumental step that the state has taken and this board had agreed to uphold. So with that report, under Part 5, Number 2, Small Forest Landowner, the legislature found that concerns should be addressed by, one, establishing a DNR Small Forest Landowner office, having a forest repair and easement program should be established, which is RCW and RCW 7613120, and that small forest landowners should have the option of alternate management plans or alternate harvest restriction on smaller harvest units.
I'd like to apologize. Rick and I actually updated this PowerPoint at 7 o'clock last night and sent it to Patricia, and so I'm using the slightly updated version from the one that you had to reiterate that we are committed to making forest and fish work, and we've toned it down a little bit. The commitments that we were given were the Forest Repair and Easement Program, which we'll call FREP, the Alternate Planning Process, and the Small Forest Landowner Office. I was the original administrator of the Small Forest Landowner Office, signed the first 41 easements, did the first 30 alternate plan ID teams. It was supposed to be a focal point and resource for small forest landowner concerns and policies. We started with a staff of 12, and we're down to somewhere around 2. The alternate planning process was supposed to provide templates with less costly prescriptions that recognize smaller harvest units. We have been successful in developing an overstock stand template, a 15-year forest practice permit, and a fixed width buffer template. None of those, however, recognize less costly prescriptions on smaller harvest units. Without FREP, it's very difficult for landowners to sign up for any of the existing template tools that we have. The fixed width buffer template, while very simple, actually in most cases requires a larger buffer than what's currently required under rule, and without funding, it's very difficult for somebody to sign up for that. A little history on the FREP program, that it was intended to pay small forest landowners for 50% of the value of the trees and the buffers and the land values included here. We've spent about $20 million since 2002. $1 million was offered in 2010, and as was mentioned earlier, we've got about 80 landowners with $10 million owed. I would also add that 19 of the first 40 easements that I signed were 100% impact. In other words, landowners could harvest no trees. some of the efforts that we've had to enforce with fish over the last decade, not insignificant. We've had the science track represented by the Family Forest Habitat Conservation Plan, many of which you are aware of, but that's a decade-long effort, about $4 million invested to put best available science into the HCP process. Forest and Fish does allow for additional HCPs. However, this process has been balled in policy, and that's unfortunate. WFFA has participated in a policy track, thousands of hours, hundreds of meetings, yeoman's effort on our WFFA policy representative. However, when we realized that our participation was simply validating a dysfunctional process, we chose to leave. We are still engaged in over 14 additional committees, including the Northwest Environmental Forum, as volunteers. We're now on a legislative track. We're going to present some more information on our 2011 legislation. I will note that in the original Forest and Fish negotiations, small forest landowner issues were never addressed. It was only through the legislative process that we got the alternate planning process, the Small Forest Landowner Office, and the Forest Repair and Easement Program. And failing the legislative track, we're left with the onerous notion of the courts.
So we are full bore ahead on a legislative solution. We feel we have a viable answer for this state, and it is just to expand an existing WAC of a 20-acre exemption rule, and instead of limiting it to 80 acres of total ownership, it will expand it to all small forest landowner office, but restrict them to a 20-acre harvest. And this is a big deal when you consider the size of harvests that are allowed. This truly is reducing the impact out there. And more importantly, or as importantly, we would forego the Forest Riparian Easement Program payment for those 20-acre harvests. The 20-acre exemption buffers, instead of varying by site class, would vary by stream size, by stream type. They are actively managed, but within the limits of other responsible management. It should be noted that 49 other states work under NOAA jurisdiction and are managing buffers across the nation and protecting their water and their fish. And it is supported by science.
We feel that this proposal fits within the Forest and Fish adaptive management process. Adaptive management is supposed to be a feedback loop that takes a look at what's working and what's not and implements solutions based on that feedback loop. We currently have a monitoring process in place for the 20-acre exemption forest practices applications at the watershed analysis unit level. The current forest practices HCP allows for up to 10% of the stream miles in any WOW to be harvested under the 20-acre exemption. These are monitoring pieces in place in our current FPHCP. The numbers here may be off by tens or so, but I think if you think about this from a order of magnitude perspective, it's still quite accurate. But to date, we've done about 900 20-acre exemption FPAs. That's out of 40,000 forest practices applications. Of the 848 WOWs, less than 100 have been affected by these FPAs, and none have exceeded 1% in stream miles affected. To put this into perspective, there are currently 170,000 small forest landowners that are eligible to participate in the 20-acre exemption. Our legislation would simply expand this eligibility to an additional 45,000 landowners. We'd really like to utilize the adaptive management process as we feel it was meant to be. We have a monitoring process in place. History suggests that the impact of expanding the 20-acre exemption eligibility will have a negligible impact on fish habitat and provide a critical incentive to maintain our family forest land ownership.
Well, our vision of adaptive management recognizes that forest and fish policy continues to suggest that the fulfillment of the commitments to the small forest landowners by that legislation must go through further adaptive management. And where we agree that forest and fish policy should be using adaptive management to implement forest and fish rules, but not to reanalyze what legislature instructed them to do. We're asking the Forest Practice Board to support our efforts to receive the commitments of forest and fish rather than to direct us to renegotiate it through adaptive management. That's a fine line, but we believe there's a decision space that there that this board could take some action and some direction on. And the benefits of our legislative solution are huge. I mean, Peter Goldman spoke earlier of, you know, some things this board could do, and I couldn't agree more with some of the comments he made. This would fit right into that. The benefits of this legislative solution is that it means the force and fish rules fully. We can be in a state that's doing the right job protecting our resources while maintaining the economic viability of our small force landowner. We can save the state millions in FRET payments annually. We increase our excise tax revenue to counties by allowing more timber to be harvested and therefore taxes collected. Provide our real jobs, real communities, and our rural communities, and protects our critical timber infrastructure, all things that is high on the governor's list. And it maintains the clean, cool water in our streams by keeping us on the landscape as a land use. So our ask simply is to have forest and fish principles, or having asked forest and fish principles for viable solution to this FRET dilemma, and hearing none that meet the existing legislative bar, we ask for your support of this legislation and believe that it could save forest and fish HCP, which should support us all.
Well, again, we'd like to thank you for your time this morning. We realize we covered a lot of information in a very little bit of time, but we'd be happy to answer any questions that you may have of us.
Questions for the presenters from the board? Anna?
Thank you for your presentation. Appreciate your time. And I was wondering, one of the slides that you had said that your request for 20-acre exemptions or buffers, that is in fact supported by science. And as we all know, that's a fundamental principle both of forests and fish and of adaptive management, making sure the public resources are protected. Would you be able to provide the board with some of that scientific backing for the proposal, or is that something that we can talk more about?
Yes, but let me let Steve answer that, as he is the has worked for 8 years or longer on that, so I don't want to steal his thunder.
I think there's a wide body of science that is available. The problem that we have within the forest and fish process is getting outside science into the cooperative monitoring and adaptive CEMER process. They don't take kindly to outside science. If you took a look at the Family Forest Habitat Conservation Plan, I think you could find a lot of the underpinnings there. But more importantly, I don't think we really need to address the science question up front. I think that we could implement this with an adaptive management process from a policy level. We've got 10 years of our inability to meet the legislative intent for small forest landowners. I think we could say, fine, from an adaptive management process, we've got something currently on the books. If we tweak the eligibility criteria here and monitor this over time, we could make it work from an adaptive management policy perspective and quite frankly, avoid a very contentious scientific battle. We lack the process that allows the preponderance of scientific information to move forward.
So, Anna, if I may, it's our belief that if we could unite the forest and fish principles under the direction of this board and request that we all go together to the federal services and suggest that a simple reanalyzing of the small forest landowner data, which we have so much information today we've never had before, which would not be too costly, and to allow this rule to go forward, that this was a legitimate solution, but it will take the cooperation and collaboration of this, all the principles of forest and fish to go forward to do that. But this is the state's HCP. The feds might hold this HCP, but this is the state's deal, and it will take our collective effort to go forward and get a change.
Tom?
Let me add my thanks for your presentation here today and for providing this material to us. That's really great to get it in advance of a legislative session. I haven't had a chance really to look in detail at the proposed language in the bill. We're just now looking at it, and so I'm sure there'll be a lot of detail that we'll want to talk with you about at some point. But I want to follow on this question of the HCP, maybe a little bit of a different angle, because my first question is, and maybe you were getting at that in your answer to Anna, was what do you think this does to the HCP? How do you think this affects the HCP? And my other piece of this, of course, is the Clean Water Act Assurances side. So, but starting with HCP, what do you see?
Well, to answer that, I would say that we have shown through the existing process that we have in place that there is room to enlarge this small forest harvest process, or what they currently call the exemption, the small forest landowner exemption for the 20. And so with that room to expand it, it would do nothing to the HCP because we have a current monitoring process in place by DNR to make sure that it does not go over that 10% threshold.
Yeah, I was going to say, that was actually a very nice point in your slides. Okay, so, that's something I'd like to know a little bit more about.
I don't think that it will
do anything to the HCP. So the 10% limitation is preserved under the language of...
Yeah, and when we reach that, we can...
And I guess, you know, from my perspective, this would strengthen the forest and fish HCP by making it work for small forest landowners, which, you know, given that we are the largest private forest landowner class in the state, would be significant.
Well, let me ask you about Clean Water Act assurances. Have you explored that side of the thing? As you may know, the Clean Water Act assurances part of this forest and fish process is in response to a TMDL lawsuit. That's a water cleanup under the Clean Water Act. Lawsuit where we're trying to utilize the forest and fish rules as an alternative to doing TMDLs in the forest environment. And the biggest issue for us on that note is temperature. We have a lot of temperature violations of the state water quality standards across there. So have you talked with folks on our staff, or have you looked at what how this might impact temperature listings in TMDL?
Yes, we have considered that, and I really think one of the things that most everybody in this room would agree to is that we've been remiss in actually monitoring water temperature since the inception of forest and fish. So far as I know, there has not been a major study to monitor water temperature since we've been in this business for 10 years, and I would suggest that we monitor water temperature upon implementation of this under the deputy management process and see if we have an issue.
And Tom, recently there's been studies done with, I get the words wrong, but CEMER work groups on some stream site studies,
yeah.
And some interesting information come forward, but I don't think there's any way to implement those in the process to address your question of have we went out and no, we haven't, but we are looking for willing partners to take the steps forward with the concept that this will work, because up to this point in time, we've had a lot of doors shut in our face as far as honest discussions about how to move forward for a viable program for small forest landowners. So, yeah. Yes, we're...
Well, I understand the motivation entirely.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
My concern here, obviously, is the protection of public resources.
Exactly.
And I'm just trying to think through what the implications are. And just maybe just to leave a comment for you on this as we go forward. You know, if we're looking at reducing shade in areas where we have temperature problems, it obviously... creates a problem for whether we're protecting the waters under the Clean Water Act. So,
I agree. But, you know, I think when you look at the data and the landscape out there, the temperature problems aren't occurring on the small forest landowner forested watersheds.
Well, I heard you previously say this is an opportunity actually to find out the impact of that. And
it
is a complicated question.
Yeah.
It is.
Other questions? Norm?
You had mentioned again on this 10% of the stream miles allowable harvest under the small forest landowner rule within the HCP. And a thought occurred to me when I was looking at the map earlier on that you showed of where these small forest landowner areas are. Have you done any analysis to determine if within any given WOW, how that overlays on the small forest landowner map? Do the small forest landowners exceed, just in their ownership, exceed 10% of just total acreage within any of those?
Excellent question. And we have done that analysis, and if I've got the numbers straight, I believe that there is only one-third of the 848 WOWs have enough small forest landowner ownership in it that they could potentially get over 10%. So there's two-thirds of the WOWs out there that couldn't even be affected if everybody in that WOW did a 20-year extension, which will never happen.
Of course.
I wish we could get everybody to do something all at once, but we can't.
And Norm, as you know, we're in an interesting situation where we're truly the buffer between a lot of our rural areas and our industrial forest lands and other lands. And you know, we should be able to think, you know, in the big picture of erring on the side of keeping us on the landscape, you know, which this rule would literally do, which is a better land use if we can maintain that. So,
thank you.
Can you talk a little bit more about how you arrived at the number of 45,000 landowners being, you know, getting the extension?
It's the remainder. It's the remainder of those that are not already.
Okay, from the data set, you can calculate how many people currently qualify based on whether they have 80 acres total ownership or less and a 20-acre parcel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the 170,000 that fall into that category. We know we have 215,000 total, so what's the difference between the two? Okay.
So, thank you also for the presentation. My question for both of you would be, the normal track for something of this nature would be through policy. Have you endeavored to take this proposal through policy to get the major caucuses to endorse and support this? Have you made that effort?
No, but not because we aren't interested in doing that. It's simply our limitations as an association. Commissioner, you know that we're stretched so thin. We all talk about our capacity. We had to leave Forest and Fish policy process over a year, well, a year ago in July, due to our budget situations and the inability to move things forward. We feel that walls were put up and doors were shut that we weren't going to get through. We are very thankful for the conversations being had and the comments being made to this board by outside people right now. But it's going to be very difficult for us to go back and engage in a lengthy process again to find results years down the road. And so I have made phone calls. We met with Miguel and the environmental community on this issue here recently. I'm trying to reach out to the tribes and others, and we're going to be reaching out to others in our limited capacity before legislation. But we are focused on legislation as a result, not the current policy process. We're hoping that this board and policy can come to agreement that supporting this would be an answer in the best interest of everyone, as well as helping get this monkey off our back and allowing you guys to get on to other things that are so important things that are on your desk. So I hope that's an answer.
Well, I guess I just expressed my interest in your pursuing it with the major partners of Forest and Fish as a preamble for any successful effort before the legislature, that it would be much more desirable to do it in advance and have something that's workable than to go into the legislature without that agreement, if you will. That's an important tenet of the whole Forest and Fish process.
Mr. Commissioner, I couldn't agree more, and I do have to remind you and this board that recently a subcommittee has been formed in Forest and Fish policy to address this small forest landowner issue. Our office was never called. We weren't contacted in regard to that. And as I learned from Miguel and others what the points are there, we have a lot of input that could have gone into that. But we have been positioned as being not collaborative, and that's we take that very seriously. We don't feel that's true. We have an open phone, and we are frank. We're frank about the fact that the past process has not worked, and we're not willing to go back to old processes and old ideas. We need some fresh new ones. We feel we brought those forward. So we feel that, yes, we could talk if we have the right parties willing to talk, but we don't think at this time that the subcommittee in Forest and Fish policy for small forest landowners is going down the right track. And we haven't been asked to engage in it.
Well, I just encourage you to continue your efforts to collaborate with all the different partners. I think many of us in state government are proud of that tradition and the terrific results that can result from collaboration, and I just encourage you to pursue those as much as possible.
We appreciate that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Steve, is that you on the picture there?
It is.
On the right or the left?
You know, he's upside down.
Upside down. He's in the bank.
That's double the net.
Double lines there. Absolutely. Right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So we haven't quite made it on the agenda to a break, but I'm going to call a break nonetheless. We'll take a break at this point and reconvene at 11:15, please.
Me too.
You just leave me online, I'll just stay here.
All right, thank you.
outreach.
Yeah, exactly.